Welcome back to the Deadology Podcast from Pencil Hill Studio, New Paltz, New York. I'm your host, Howard Weiner. This is Season 2, Episode 31, and this is the English Town Grateful Dead Extravaganza. Today is September 3rd, 2024, the 47th anniversary of English Town. On tonight's podcast, we're going to have two gentlemen on who were at Raceway Park English Town on that day. For one of them, it was their first Grateful Dead show. The other one, it was like second or third. Author Jim Daly, who also wrote a book on English Town, will be joining us. And Doc Rich Weiss, English Town, one of the most famous shows from the storied year of 1977. And later on, I'm going to make a case for why it must be why it may be the most impactful Grateful Dead show ever played. But before we get to our guests tonight, Jim and Doc, I'd like to share my English Town tale. English Town plays such a big part from my generation of Deadheads. It was the first show for so many people, and also it was the first tape. It was a very widely circulated radio tape, and that's my case. It was my first Grateful Dead bootleg, and the day I got it, it instantly changed my life. Now, there's about five or six concerts or events in my life musically that I could say changed my life. This is definitely up there, man, the English Town tape. So let me just give you a brief run-up to how I became a Deadhead and how the English Town tape impacted me. 1981, January, I heard Europe 72 for the first time coming back from an Islander game. And boy, it blew me away because I never heard anything. I've heard the Grateful Dead before, but I never heard songs like Jack Straw, Cumberland. It hit me. This band is onto something that no other band, or at least rock band, does. So right away, I went out. I bought a bunch of Grateful Dead albums. Saw my first show March 9th, 1981 at Madison Square Garden. Enjoyed it. They played some cool tunes that I wanted to see, but I was still too novice because the great improvisational jams that night were still, I still didn't really get it. It was, the jams are just so long. If you're 17 and you're listening to classic rock and pop hits all your life, making the transition to the Grateful Dead, it's like a different language altogether. So I really needed to get into some bootleg tapes. There were two things missing that really, I can't say I was a Deadhead yet or insane about the Grateful Dead, even though I had the albums and I saw a show. It came down to two things for me, two questions that still I really couldn't answer. Why do people follow the Grateful Dead around night after night? It didn't make sense to me. You're seeing the same band over and over again. There might be a few different songs. But I didn't get that part of how Deadheads were just so religiously following the band. And also the reverence for Garcia. I mean, people talked about Jerry Garcia like he was a god, like he was undoubtedly the greatest guitarist in the world. And I'd yet to make that connection, basically because I'm listening to some studio albums and I didn't have the bootleg tapes. It's probably April of 81, because I know by May I had bootleg tapes and I was seeing my second show in Nassau Coliseum. Let's call it a weekday, April 81. I'm going to high school, Clarkstown South, West Nyack, New York. And I did what I did on a typical day. Before homeroom, I approached the drug dealers who were also students, good guys. You know, they would take their time to roll up joints and sell them for a dollar. You know, so the reason I would get my joints before homeroom is you get a pick of 20 joints. So I could always pick out the fattest ones if I got to the guys right away. If you wait to lunch, you may not get a joint. And if you do, it's going to be skinny for sure. So it was always good to get your joints first thing in the morning. And, you know, I picked out a couple and the guy says to me, he's like, Howie, I got some bootleg tapes of different bands. This, you know, check out this list. And I took the list, and I can't remember the other bands that were on there, but I was happy to know the Grateful Dead were on there. I can't remember the other tapes that were available. I didn't look at a song list. I don't even know if there was a song list on there. I just saw the word English Town. It chose me. There was no doubt that was the tape I was buying. And the reason why English Town was ensconced in my brain, when I was a kid, I would listen to WABC radio every day, constantly. All the pop hits, I was on top of that for a number of years. And the most memorable radio commercial was for Raceway Park, English Town. There would be an announcer, and it would sound something like this. Ho, 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 welcome to Raceway Park, English Town, New Jersey. Almost like a helium effect. And it was just, you could not forget this commercial because you would hear it every day during the summer. And they would talk about drag racing and funny cars, and none of that stuff interested me, but just like that commercial stood in my brain, and obviously that's why I picked out the tape. I figured, hey, this is probably a good place to start, and boy, what a lucky pick that was. By the way, I paid $7 for that tape. Only time I ever paid for a Grateful Dead bootleg tape, and it was the best investment of my life because, man, that tape did the job. So it's first period, and I decide I'm going to cut a few classes. Usually I would go out and smoke with people in the woods, but I went out by myself. I was on a mission to hear this tape. You know, and it starts off pretty good. Promised Land, Love Each Other, Me and my Uncle. I'm like, yes, this is it, man. Live Dead, I'm getting it. But I wasn't getting it because the next song hit me over the head like, oh my God, the Mississippi Half Step Uptown Toodaloo from English Town. Obviously one of the greatest versions of that song ever, if not the greatest, probably most people would look at it as the number one half step. And I listened to it and I really dug the song Half Step. I knew it, but the leap that they took forward on this was incredible. I'd heard Led Zeppelin improvise on their live album Song Remains the Same, and that was pretty impressive. You know, I had the live Lynyrd Skynyrd, there were other live rock band albums I had, but I had never heard like an improvement and an improvisation like I had heard on this Mississippi Half Step from what I knew of the song. The versions I knew were, but we're talking studio albums, were obviously Wake of the Flood and Steal Your Face, which is a pretty good version, but definitely not anywhere near as dynamic or as long as the one from English Town. So hearing this just blew my mind. I was like, the Grateful Dead could do that? The post Rio Grande jam. Oh man, they just kill it on that. And you hear the crowd explode after they finish, or at least what they think is finished. Then Keith starts playing and Jerry hears what Keith's doing. And once again, they're off on another just really improvised thing like in no other Mississippi half step. And I'm just like, I was stunned. I'm just listening to this. I never heard music like this before. It was so powerful. This was like everything I was looking for in music. Was right there. So this tape, it was a 90-minute BASF tape. I didn't, for $7, I didn't even get a TDK or a Maxell. I got like a garbage cassette tape. But this tape hung in there for as long as I needed it. So, you know, you got the half step. Only half of the first set was on side one. Side two had only partial set two. But luckily on that partial set two, it started with Estimated Eyes Samson. And that Eyes of the World just tore my head off, much like the half step did. I could not believe it. The only version I ever heard of Eyes of the World was Wake of the Flood. Just to hear these songs become so more illuminated, huge, over what they were on the albums. I'm like, my God, if this band is doing this on this one night, and they switch up their sets and they sound different every night, how many other great tapes are there like English Town? And from that point forward, I went nuts just collecting tapes. I became much tighter friends with Doug, who had already gotten to the Grateful Dead. And he tried getting me into them. I was, you know, it's like learning a foreign language. You know, it's got to hit you at the right time. And the Grateful Dead is definitely different than the rest of the rock world. There should be rock and roll, jazz, blues, and in like a, if I don't know if there's still album stores out there, but if you're talking about sections in a music store, the Grateful Dead should have their own section because they cover everything and nothing covers them. So it's really kind of like learning a new musical dialect, getting into the Grateful Dead. But yeah, when it hit me forget it, man. It was like onward, forward. By my next show, which was a month later in Nassau, I probably had about 20 bootleg tapes, and I was on my way to an awesome life of following the Dead for about 8 or 9 years. So let's enjoy the brilliance of one of those English Town half-step jams, and then we'll segue into my conversation the other day with Jim Daly.
Rock and ride, good health to you, old southern skies. I'm on my
All right, now joining us on the Deadology podcast is author Jim Daly. He has two books out, Grateful Memories, a book on his years of taping. He was a taper. Jim, how many years did you tape with the Dead about?
Specifically from 79 to 89.
Wow, cool. A good solid 10 years. That was about the, you know, I was into them from about 82 to 89. So we were on the same year length. I didn't see him as much after that. And your latest book, which came out a few years back, I read it a few years back, enjoyed it. Deadheads Remember English Town 77. And that's perfect on point. So glad to have you here. You could share some stuff with us. Was that your first show, English Town?
It was. The English Town came up because friends in my neighborhood were going to the show, and one of those friends turned me on to Mars Hotel, the first album. The U.S. Blues was the first song I ever heard. Wow. And they said, listen to this song, you're really gonna like it. And it totally hit me. Like I've always been an AM hits kind of guy, like when I was a kid. And U.S. Blues was like nothing I'd ever heard before. So it was very intriguing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely entering a new realm. I went through the same thing, WABC radio hits. And, they always used to advertise for English Town. That's why English Town was on. I knew it would be a great tape when I heard it. You're getting into the Grateful Dead. So this is going to be your first concert. Take us through the experience of going there and what it was like.
It was a strange one for me. I was only 15. Wow. So a couple of friends were catching a ride Friday night to Raceway Park. I had no idea what Raceway Park was. I had no idea what English Town was, where it was. I got in the back seat with two friends, and we got dropped off we got dropped off pretty close to the gate, because we had a family friend was dating one of the guys that ran the motocross track. So we were able to stay inside the motocross area and camp inside, which was very convenient. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, would have been tough if you went on Saturday the following day if you went to the show. It would have been a crazy scene getting in there.
That part of it, I did not experience that. The traffic jams, I didn't experience that rush of crowd that most people experienced from going out there Saturday morning to the afternoon hours. And some people didn't care about getting there for the first band, whatever their excuses were. But the first band, from what I understand, Marshall Tucker was a big draw that year.
They were before New Riders.
No, the New Riders. That's how I said that. The New Riders opened up, but as I've spoken to people over the years, the Marshall Tucker Band was a big draw for a lot of people that had already seen New Riders play around and had already been Deadheads for a while, because we had that 1977 tour that everyone, a lot of Deadheads had been on that tour.
Yeah, so they had a hit song at the time, "Heard It in a Love Song." They were definitely pretty popular. Yeah.
I remember hearing that song very vividly.
All right. So you're up the next day. You probably didn't sleep much,
No, it was, we slept on the ground. There was no tent involved. I don't really remember. I was a Boy Scout, so I mean, I didn't have a tent with me. Don't even ask me why, but, we slept between two cars on the hardened dirt of a racetrack, how hard that dirt can be. And then on the next morning, we just made our way to the gate. I had little or nothing with me. I didn't bring a cooler. I didn't bring anything. But I had friends who were all prepared.
Oh, cool. That's good. Yeah. It sounds like they almost, you were a willing hostage. You just kind of went along. You didn't plan it out.
I was a bit of a, I've never referred to it that way before, but I think I may have been a willing hostage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so the day starts, it's hot out. Well, was it hot out? I'm assuming
it was a very hot day. Some people liken it to the RFK in 86, how hot it was. Wow. That day people were getting sprayed by hoses. John Shearer did as much as he possibly could to alleviate that problem, although when you're in the middle of a field and the sun's beating down on you, there's not really, I don't know. When I spoke to John twice on the phone in with regards to this book, and he was, there's little you can do to prepare for that, but the band was aware of it. John was aware of it. You know, they just did the best they could, I guess.
Yeah, you just you got to find a way to avoid sunstroke, man. It's
finding a way to avoid sunstroke is that's a good way to put it. I do remember the mud building up around where the fountains were. There were a couple of working water fountains, and there was a long trailer that was you know, for the restrooms. And so right around that area, there developed an inch or two of mud that we had to walk through to get to facilities, so to speak.
Well, yeah, and people must have found a way to enjoy that later on. Somehow people always like jumping in the mud. There's mud people. Some people were born to be mud people. There must have been a few there in English Town.
Some people were born to do that, yes. I was not one of them.
Hey, so for the concert, were you reasonably close? Did you manage to stay in the pretty close to the stage? Or
I have to believe I was about halfway, which is as a deadhead like you and all the rest of us, we know that if you're not right up close so you can see the musicians play their guitars, which I always love to do, being back in the general area of where the soundboard would be is the sweet spot. I was not taping that day, but that's the area that we generally shoot for, you know, because that's where the sound's being controlled, and that's where you have to figure it sounds the best.
Yeah, definitely. It's sometimes it's just too much to wade through. There was over 100,000 there. Do you remember what the count was approximately? You hear anywhere from 100 to 150. What's your understanding on that?
The my understanding was the newspaper called 125 to 150,000, like you said. I think I can't generally tell how big the crowd is, but I think a lot of people thought there was 150,000 people there. John Shear disputes that. If he was on this call with us right now, he would say, nope, everybody bought a ticket and everybody was there. 125,000. And when he said that to me on the phone, on the call, I kind of laughed. I said, I don't think, well, you know what? He goes, well, I'm a pretty good judge of a crowd from a helicopter, Jim. And, I would say that this is the amount of people were there. And, I have to, you know, I have to agree because he's the pro. So, I mean, I have no idea. But I know that was crowded.
Yeah, you know, several thousand must have got in somehow, but it sounds like they had that under control. So you're enjoying Marshall Tucker and New Riders. Obviously, the great excitement was for the Grateful Dead. Did you notice like a change in the crowd when the Grateful Dead took the stage? That was definitely like the...
I have to believe that there was excited anticipation for the Grateful Dead, because they hadn't been they had been on this exciting tour in 77 that we all know about now.
Yeah.
And this was the first time they played in the whole summer went by without a Dead show.
That's true.
So I mean, it was the first appearance of a lot of songs they hadn't played in a while since then, and the crowd was immense from their point of view too. You know, even Phil mentioned, you know, let's hear it for you guys, because you're the best, you're the biggest crowd we've seen in a long time. And you can hear that on the tapes from NEW, the broadcast and all that. You can hear a lot of crazy stage talk. But it was John said it was a very exciting day for them because they hadn't played really to a crowd that big in a very, very long time. They were very excited about it.
Yeah. And Mickey had just come off an injury, too. So, it was a huge show. So John Shear introduced him, the best band in the land, the Grateful Dead. And they're often firing. What songs hit you when you were first out there?
The first song, being a very new deadhead, I don't even consider myself a deadhead at that time. I was there to enjoy a weekend of music, and I had just been introduced to this new band. And I remember hearing "Friend of the Devil." I was familiar with that song, and I remember hearing "The Eyes of the World," and those two songs were so stretched apart, like, you know, first set, second set. The estimated profit into "Eyes of the World," as we know, was epic. You know, that's one of the great pairings of Grateful Dead music that we've experienced, and that "Eyes of the World" still stands up. you know,
Definitely, man. It's beloved. People definitely consider that one of the best ever. And then also
sure.
the Mississippi Half Step and that fourth song, that was just
absolutely
killer.
Oh my goodness!
Killer.
Please forgive me for not saying Mississippi Half Step first. That's the I didn't know the song then, but since then I have come to believe in my heart that Mississippi Half Step was one of the best ever,
yeah,
for sure. Even
and
going back to the original versions in 74, not 75, but 73, 74. It's just that's just a magnificent version of that song.
Yeah, I think it would have to be by a consensus of Deadheads that would be the best Mississippi Half Step, and I've always thought that. I'm beginning to think Rochester 77's up there with it, but the English Town
yeah.
one is definitely longer and more original. Yeah, so you're catching all this great stuff. Music Never Stopped, and the song selection was incredible on that day. Not bad for $12.50.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny you brought up Rochester 77. That's a lot of people's favorite show too.
Yeah. Yeah,
That's
that was a great little three show run up there, the Colgate, Rochester, Binghamton.
Yeah, for sure. I can talk all day with you about the Grateful Dead, man.
Yeah, we could always just shoot off topic pretty easily, man. So the what other interesting things do you remember from? I know you did an interview with Cher in the book. Anything else interesting that he had to say about English Town?
He mentioned the crowd size. He mentioned the helicopter. He mentioned the birth of the baby. You know, he
do you
mentioned
remember
that.
Do you remember
huh?
Do you remember the helicopter coming in?
No, I don't. But there's a couple of there's a nice picture of the helicopter taken off from behind the stage in my book. I mean, it's black and white, but it's still a picture of the helicopter.
Yeah. Wow, they did a pretty, you know, without making too big of a deal, it happened, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember anything being mentioned about it, and even in the audio that I got a lot of the audio, the transcript in the book from one of the archive tapes that I happened to come across. A lot of the stuff, like the stuff about Mickey looking up at the sky and at the aliens that he was talking to through his headphones,
yeah.
You know, because Bobby likes to mess with his bandmates. That's a couple of things. During our interview, we also talked about John Belushi and Saturday Night Live and a couple of other things like that. But I did ask him about the preparation for English Town, whether they were, so to speak, mentally prepared for the crowd size that they actually had. And he said that as problems, as situations came up, they dealt with the problem firsthand and then moved on. So anything that came up, it didn't really seem that drastic to him at the time. But looking back at it, he said there were several problems that they avoided, and a lot of stuff just happened. You know how when you go on tour and things happen and you just take care of it.
Yeah,
that's kind of.
Yeah, it sounds like that's part of life on the road, whether you're a promoter or whatever,
yeah.
Just avoiding tragedy, that's a success.
There's always logistical things during, you know, like in a promoter's life or in a traveling Deadhead's life that as problems come up, you just take care of them and move on, you
yeah.
know? So that was his experience on a much larger level.
Yeah, so you catch all these major tunes, man. You got the Truckin', the Terrapin Encore was huge. So you leave English Town. Would you say you were changed as a person? Was that the concert, the moment that, see, I got to go back, I got to make this part of my life? Did it hit you like that?
No. I came home. I still don't know. I guess I didn't ask the right person. I still don't really know how I got home from the show, but I remember being home and thinking that I had experienced something amazing. I did not know what to make of it. I didn't think to myself, when can I go see these guys again? I realized that it's the first family weekend of camping on Labor Day weekend that I hadn't participated in since I mean, my family went camping every weekend for that weekend for my whole life. And I just realized, because my brother and I both went, and I realized that I'm pretty sure this was a pretty epic experience, but I didn't really know what to make of it.
Wow.
My,
when was the next time you saw the Grateful Dead after this?
In January of 79 at the Spectrum.
Oh, cool.
January 2nd. Those shows
at that point, were you into the were you into the like were you did you get bootleg tapes at that point? Or were you just getting into them?
By then, I had, yes, I had met a guy in school who we started talking back and forth because I was wearing Grateful Dead shirts. And this guy turned me on to live tapes. I started getting tapes from him, and I would walk across the street to the family that turned me on to the Grateful Dead, and I would put it in my little Panasonic tape deck, and we would listen to these shows. And by the time the following fall in 78, when we were supposed to go to the Capitol Theater to see the Grateful Dead play, and that was when Garcia got that bad bronchitis and all those shows were canceled.
Yeah.
So
late 78.
Right. So the next shows that I went to were the Spectrum and Garden shows that were bookended in January. Spectrum, Garden, Spectrum, if I remember correctly.
Yep. And it Keith, the end of the Keith Arrows last month or so, you're going to be able to see Keith and Donna.
Right. So I got to see Keith and Donna four more times after Englishtown. And then in April of that year, they left. Yeah. So,
hey, going back to Englishtown, you have a lot of cool stories in there from different people. Is there anything that really jumped out that a story from somebody that you recall that?
One story, my friend Joe, who lives out in California now, he told me a great story about having a huge cooler full of beer and ice that he was trying to get in the front door. And as it turned out, he knew somebody through a Bruce connection. He knew somebody at the door, and they were just like, let him in. And I was shocked at that, you know, because a lot of people did get coolers full of beer in. I don't know how at 15. I don't know. I didn't know anything about that stuff. So I was very, very unprepared.
Did they sell beer inside, or that you had to basically bring in the coolers?
No. Actually, there were vendors inside. I didn't really visit the vendors very much. I think we just had sodas and beers and some sandwiches and stuff. I'm sure I must have eaten something, but I don't know what it was.
Wow, man, a hell of a scene, man. Just I know how hot it could get on Labor Day, you know, and just because I there are some videos. I'm sure you've seen them. There are a couple like little videos where they're not. You can't actually see the band, but you could see the raceway. They're on YouTube. Did you see those videos or?
Yeah, I've seen a bunch of a compilation of videos from people who were working. I actually have, I didn't mention, I actually have two good friends that worked concessions that day, and they were there for 3 days before the band started playing. Wow. They were helping set the stage up and stuff like that. And my friend Donnie, who told me his story, they were behind one of the concessions selling hot dogs or sodas or whatever they were doing. And they, as soon as the music started, they said, you know what, screw this, took their aprons off. They didn't worry about getting paid. I think they were getting paid, you know, $1.50 an hour or something. And they just left, and they went out to the crowd to watch the show because they were no longer interested in, you know, in being employed for the weekend. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what you do when you're 18 years old, you know?
Oh yeah. I quit a paper route one day right in the middle of a paper route, man. The Grateful Dead weren't playing, but it's much easier to walk away from things when you're younger, man.
Yeah, for sure.
No consequences, man. But hey, that sounded like an amazing afternoon, and it definitely put you on the track of becoming a taper and all that. So, while we're at it, how'd you get into the taping? How'd you decide to become a taper?
I have a very good friend who I met out at McNichols in '79 when the Red Rock shows were canceled due to rain. And my friend Tom turned me on to tapes. And he was the first guy that I got tapes from who was actually recording them. They were masters. And I was intrigued by that. After I got those tapes from him, I started noticing in the audience sections of people here and there, not a taping section yet, of course, but sections where people were, they had gathered their D5s that had been really, really, really new then. And they were just, they had these mics in the air. And I was like, this is so cool. And I just wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be part of that experience to walk out to my car and put a cassette tape in my car, you know, I mean, before I realized that card decks eat tapes.
Yeah, hey man, it was great, man. I'm surprised. I guess I never got into it because I knew tapers. I knew I was going to get the tape. So yeah, so I enjoyed the show, and it is a beautiful thing when someone comes out to the car with the tape, and you get to see if it was as hot as you thought it was.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the better things about it. I mean, one of the things that intrigued me about being part of that scene was also you can trade tapes for so long before someone says, "Hey, what have you got to trade for it?" And if I have masters, you know, I had that Spectrum show from 79, I had that Spectrum show from 81 or wherever it was from. And they were like, "Oh yeah, you have that? Well, I have this from, you know, from 73 that I got from another friend." You know, the tapes were, I always felt like I was very generous with trading because of the way certain people can be very, I don't know. I think there's a stinginess involved with it way, way back, you know, like if you don't have anything to trade, then I don't have it. You know, I don't have any use for you. I mean, you don't get that much, of course, you know that.
Yeah. Most people had tapes. You had a curry favor with them for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Curry favor. That's a good way to put it.
Yes. Because you wanted it so bad and so many people wanted it. They couldn't just, so it was, no, it was like, as soon as I found someone who had a collection, I found a way to curry favor.
Right. Curry favor. Exactly. Yes.
Hey, so time's running out here. Thanks for joining us. Once again, could you tell people out there listening to the podcast where they could find your book? What will be the ideal place to find it?
Sure. They're both available on Amazon. You can order them that way.
Jim Daly, thanks for joining us here on the podcast. Man, 1977 to be at Englishtown. What a time, man. What an incredible peak experience for the Grateful Dead, which was probably more obvious than any of their previous years, regardless if you think 72 is better, which is hard to argue with, or 73 or 74. The Grateful Dead were... It was the right year for them, and they came out with the right songs, and they played the right stuff at the right time. So in May, they had that great run, Cornell, and all the shows wrapped around it, Boston, Buffalo, New Haven, the incredible Hartford Sugary, Alabama, May 17th, the Fox Theater shows, Hollywood Sportatorium. And I'm missing so many great ones. Just the entire month was ridiculous. A great one, run in the Winterland in June. They were great right from the beginning. Hell, with the Swing Auditorium show to start the whole year off. Jeez, such a great year. They came out with the Grateful Dead album. Not the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead movie was finally released early June, and it premiered in New York City and out on the West Coast. They ran it for a little bit. And then basically, it's an essential movie, you know, deadheads love it. It eventually became a cult movie, which I watched many times in the year 1981. They used to have it in my college, Rockland Community College. But that was such a look forward to movie, the Grateful Dead movie, nothing like it, you know, just incredible work. So they're riding that high of the movie. And they also came out with Terrapin Station, a new album of songs with the brilliant masterpiece Terrapin, Estimated Profit, a bunch of enjoyable tunes, great stuff which they were working into the shows, Dancing in the Street, Fire on the Mountain. 77 gives us the birth of Scarlet Fire, Estimated Eyes. So everything, the ball's just rolling and everything's just exactly perfect. Mickey had an injury, but he was feeling better. They come to Englishtown September 3rd, and they were on a mission, man, because... for one thing, this concert was the number one box office receipts of any musical festival or act that year. Incredible. David Davis, who was on the podcast a few months ago, sent me a billboard cutout that showed it, laid it out for me. I think number two was Peter Frampton with a bunch of people. Led Zeppelin was a few spots below. But Grateful Dead, New Riders, Marshall Tucker, they were the number one musical draw. With the greatest receipts from the summer of 1977. I didn't know that until David sent that to me. So thanks, Dave. He also went to Englishtown. I think it was like his eighth or ninth show. And mentioned that he walked about 7 miles to get there after they had to park their car and walk about 7 miles. So it was a crazy, wild scene out there. And man, the Grateful Dead, it's just incredible how they delivered on this particular show. I mean, there's 125 to 150,000 people out there. You know, it's a huge spectacle. It's warm. But hey, this was their year. They conquered almost every, I think, every situation they were in during the year. So it should really, if you look at the year, it's not much of a surprise, but this was, you know, you're out there in an untypical situation in a racetrack, English town, New Jersey, a lot of pressure on you, but 1977, they were able to handle anything and everything. And boy, did they deliver on this night. So I'm going to play a little bit of the English town Eyes of the World, which there's so many great eyes from 1977. I probably got this around number five, or I definitely don't think it's the best, but it's pretty great and it's unique. This second solo we're going to listen to, it's like this galloping horse kind of rhythm going on, and then Garcia just goes nuts towards the end of it. So it's a very distinctive jam, and we'll hear that before we segue into conversation with Doc Richweiss. Joining me on the Deadology podcast to talk about the English Town show, a friend of mine from Manhattan. I met him about 15 years ago. We went to a lot of shows at the Beacon Theater. His name is Doc Richweiss. And one of the first shows he saw was English Town. Doc, hey, well, thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
And quickly, before we get into the whole English Town thing, I got to tell you this, man. We didn't see each other, but I read a post that you were at the Grateful Dead Festival in Warwick last week.
I was, yes, I was.
You didn't see me, did you?
No, were you there?
I didn't see you either. That's incredible. We were both at this festival, which was kind of intimate, only maybe a couple hundred people.
Well, I was there only, I was only there on Sunday.
I saw the pictures. I was like, I can't believe I didn't run into you.
Oh.
I wasn't on the hill that much, and my friend played with Jeb Jones, so I was on the side more. But we,
actually, I went with a buddy of mine who's in Jeb Jones.
Wow, that's the craziest thing, man. I didn't even mention these before we got on air, man. But yeah, just crazy that we both were there. We didn't bump into each other. We haven't seen each other in years, and that's insane that somehow we didn't see each other.
Really? Yeah.
Hey, but anyway, let's get back to Englishtown. So yeah, such a huge show. Take us back. Tell us like how you got into the Grateful Dead, where you were at the time of Englishtown, and what that day was like, starting with the day going into Englishtown.
So that would have been Englishtown was right at the beginning of my junior year in college. I went to college at Lafayette. And so I wasn't a Dead fan at all until I went to college, which was September of 1975. So by 77, 2 years later, through my college fraternity friends, I was big time turned onto the Dead. My college, Lafayette College, you could walk around campus and you heard Springsteen and you heard the Dead and not too much else.
Yeah, same thing with me, except it wasn't as much Springsteen in Rockland County. It was mostly all Dead, but colleges in those areas are huge breeding grounds. So sorry to interrupt. Continue, please. Right.
So, you go to school and your mind gets expanded in a lot of different ways. I was a pretty conservative kid growing up, but when I went away for the first time, I was turned on to, among other things, lots and lots of different music, but the one that made the most impression was the Dead. So I went to my first show the summer after my freshman year, and then which was the summer of 76. So then the following summer, 77, I had a bunch of good friends who lived in the Jersey Shore area. So five or six of us got together and decided let's hit Englishtown.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible. So the huge mob scene coming in there that day.
Huge mob scene.
It had Marshall Tucker playing and
New Riders.
So yeah, huge concert for the area. Probably the biggest, definitely the biggest concert the area has ever seen. What was it like pulling in? How close did you get to the concert site? Did you have to park your car miles away? Give us that scene.
It kind of felt like, remember, this is 1977. So Woodstock was, not that I went to Woodstock, but Woodstock was in the relatively recent past, right? Woodstock was only 8 years prior to that. Yeah. And Watkins Glen, I guess, was only 3 or 4 years before that. So I remember being aware of all these horror stories about the New York State Thruway being closed and people parking all over the place in Watkins Glen. And we were joking about it. And that's exactly what happened to us. The Englishtown community was in no way prepared to handle the onslaught of automobiles that hit the town that day.
Yeah. How long before what time did you show up? Did you?
I remember so my friends lived at Jersey Shore, not that far away. Probably it was maybe a 45-minute drive from where we started out in Little Silver, New Jersey. But I seem to recall it took us about 2 hours to get to even walking distance. And we parked on somebody's front lawn. It was just like you hear about in Woodstock. You just see us open lawn, you pull in, you pay somebody $10 and hope that your car is there when you get back. Yeah. You hope you can find your car when you get back, you know? Yeah. Without GPS, you just end up, a bunch of college kids, smoking a lot of weed, I'm sure. The fact that we even made it to our car afterwards, to me, is a modern miracle.
Yeah.
But we got there in time for the opening bands because the joke was we were pretty far away and we didn't really know who was playing. Is it Marshall Tucker? Is it New Riders? Until we heard Somebody Robbed the Glendale Train. And as soon as they played Somebody Robbed the Glendale Train, we said, oh, okay, this must be the New Riders.
Yeah.
I don't remember who came first, the New Riders or Marshall Tucker, to be honest with you. But
it was New Riders first, I believe. I wasn't there, but from...
Is that how... When do you think? Okay.
Yeah,
so I remember hearing Glendale Train. It's the first song I remember hearing. So then we said, okay, this must be the New Riders, which means we were there for Marshall Tucker and then, of course, for the Dead. But we weren't that close. We were pretty far away. But I do remember the sound being pretty, pretty pure. Like, even though we were far away and there was no video screens, you could see these little dots walking around on a stage. But you could hear no problem.
That's definitely an old school experience, because like these days they got the huge screens whenever they have the big festivals. So yeah, definitely taking us back. No big screens. But it was important. The music was nice and loud. That's pretty cool. So when you got there, you still couldn't get pretty close to the stage. Was it like, did it get mobbed after a while?
My recollection is that it was kind of a mob scene, and we got as close as we could, but as close as we could was not that close. You know, I don't have any pictures, you know. It wasn't like I was going to bring a big bulky camera in there, and, you know, no cell phones. And there are surprisingly very little photographs, or I don't know if I've seen any video at all of English Town, which is kind of a shame.
There is one on YouTube, but you know, it's not like a focused on the band as much as the whole scene. It was a still camera that was sitting there for a little bit. I'm glad you brought that up. I have to look for that. If I run into it again, I'll send you the link for it when I find it. I didn't take a look at it before doing this, but that reminds me that I should go back to that, because you could just see all the people out there kind of milling around. And were you on Blacktop or Raceway or?
We were on, I believe it was a grass field. I don't remember being on Blacktop. So I guess it was the infield of the Raceway, because I seem to recall it was grass. So it wasn't Blacktop.
Yeah, it was a lot of both Blacktop.
Yeah, and I remember being there. Like, it was crowded, but I don't remember being like necessarily uncomfortable.
It was ridiculously hot. Am I correct? Was it a very hot day?
Well, you know, it was fall, so it was kind of a day probably like it is today. Isn't actually today almost, we're getting close to the anniversary, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, it's September 3rd. We're pretty close. I think it's Tuesday's the anniversary.
Right. Away. So it was. I remember it being a day like today, not being particularly. I don't remember it being particularly steamy or uncomfortable. I remember being like, you know, dressed properly, however I dressed that day. I don't have any pictures. But considering how many people and how far we had to walk to get there, I don't remember hardships. I don't remember having issues getting to a bathroom or getting some water. And I read about afterwards that it was kind of a shit show. But in my recollection is that it was all about the music. The music was so righteous. And that's what I remember most. Not any, you know, the walk a little bit, but it was really that the music was good. And I, again, as a 20-year-old kid, you can put up with heat and cold and all that stuff, right?
Do you remember the helicopter, the pregnant woman? She went into labor. They had to bring a helicopter. And do you remember that scene?
I do not remember that, to be perfectly honest with you. I remember hearing that story, and you'd think, how could I not notice a helicopter? But I don't. I can't.
You're sitting on the grass, smoking a joint, and you know, having a good time. But it was between. You might have been between before the dead started.
Okay, and I was probably doing just that back then. Back then, I was a pretty heavy weed smoker, and I am sure we were, just as you described. There was like five or six of us. We were probably sitting around smoking weed and oblivious that a helicopter might be coming down above our heads. Hey, one of my first crystal clear memories of the day that I do have several was Bobby screwing up like the first verse of The Promised Land.
Yeah, they opened up with Promised Land, and yeah.
And John, right, John right Cher the first introduces verse. Him.
Wow.
he missed the line, and I remember we noticed it. We all looked at each other and laughed. And then I think the next line, and he was like, "That's right." Like, he kind of corrected himself. He goes, "That's right." Yeah. I remember that. And then I remember, I guess it was Phil asking everybody to take a step back.
Yep. And then came the killer Mississippi half step.
The best Mississippi. We've you and I have spoken about that. The best Mississippi half step ever, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. And it's different. 77, they had a lot of great half steps. That one's a little different. The jams are longer. They break it down. They rebuild it. Awesome version. We're definitely going to hear some of that on the podcast. So great half step. Take a step back. Did you notice it being that tight where you were that the step back was necessary? Or,
well, I remember like kind of thinking, how are you going to get 100,000 people to do anything? It seemed like it was kind of a it was good in theory. I guess people were getting really crushed up front, but I remember thinking like, we don't have to move because we're so far back. And it wasn't like if I took a step back, that was going to make any type of a difference. And the people in front of us, like it didn't really affect our situation. I remember hearing the announcement and said it's good in theory. And if the people in front of me would have moved back, of course I would have moved back too. But the wave of people moving back, it never really got back to where I was.
That's really, really more for the people up front, so you get a little room up there.
Exactly. I'm kind of, I remember hearing that and thinking, oh man, I'm glad we're not up there because it must be kind of tough.
So a great first set that day. I think the second set's even killer, probably the
Well,
better part. But what else do you remember from the first set that really
from
grabbed
the
you, like?
first set, there's a few, again, very clear images. I mean, I can hear that the guitar solos and the guitar solo, plural, in half step, like in my mind. The other songs that I think don't get enough credit on that show were the "Looks Like Rain." The guitar solo at the end of "Looks Like Rain" was just otherworldly. The same with Peggy O. I think it might be the best Peggy O I've ever heard.
There's two guitar solos in that. So that probably would have stood out. I think he caught a friend of the devil in the first set also. Am I correct?
Right, the friend of the devil, and I think there was "They Love Each Other," if I recall correctly. Was there "Me and My Uncle" also?
I
Right.
think that was before the half step to me and my uncle.
Okay, but the songs that stood out that I remember clearly from the first set were those three that I mentioned: the half step, the "Looks Like Rain," which you don't really think of as a song where you get a killer guitar solo because it's a Bobby song, but you know what I'm talking about? That guitar at the end of "Looks Like Rain" was incredible.
When Jerry's inspired in that, he could do some cool stuff in there. But also, I think "Looks Like Rain" is just a song we heard so much through the years that it's so commonplace that it doesn't usually doesn't stick out as a highlight. But hey, early in your career, I loved "Looks Like Rain" for the first couple of years when I was following the Dead, and then I just grew tired of it.
And then I think that like I've always loved Peggy O, and that might have been because remember, this was only my second Dead show, so I still wasn't entirely, versed in their, the depth of their catalog. But I think it might have been the first time I heard Peggy O. Like it might have been a song that I wasn't entirely familiar with. But I remember that I was blown away by how beautiful it was. And to this day, it's still one of my favorites.
That makes sense because it wasn't on any albums at that point. It was sort of new. I think 74 was the first year if I'm correct, they played it in. It kind of got into the rotation in 77, really. So it
So
really
it's
is kind
not,
of,
it wouldn't be unusual that I was somewhat unfamiliar with it then.
And then the set ender was pretty powerful. Music never stopped.
"Music Never Stopped" as a set ender, which I guess "Blues for Allah." Well, yeah, that had been out for a couple years already. But I remember "Blues for Allah" was probably the first record that I heard like as a new record, so the "Help on the Way," Franklin's "Music Never Stopped." That was pretty exciting to hear that because that was like the first, like, oh, this is like kind of my Dead record. This is a new one,
New Dead. This is my generation, not the old 69,
right?
71 stuff.
Exactly, right? Because "Blues for Allah" came out after their 1 or 2 year, or I guess 1 year hiatus.
Right before the while they were in the hiatus, right before they came back and started touring again. Then he
Right.
got set two. What
So,
was it, Bertha, I think, opened Bertha.
yeah. What I remember set two was a Bertha again. To me, the Bertha is another song that people don't talk about from English Town. The guitar solo in Bertha is unbelievable. Unbelievable. One of my favorites. And then I believe it was Bertha into "Good Lovin'."
Amazing in front of such a big crowd that they were able to be play so hot. It was the other big shows like the Woodstock, they really didn't come off good, but this they were on the money the whole
On the
show.
money, the "Bertha Good Lovin'" was great. I think "The Loser" was in the second set, which is really what I consider a second set song.
And it's "Bertha Good Lovin'," I "Loser," I think, was the flow there. Then
And
they went back to
I remember
Terrapin, the
"Terrapin."
new
Well,
album.
no, "Terrapin" was later. I think it was "Terrapin."
I meant the album Terrapin with
Okay.
Estimated Profit. He had his eyes, obviously
Right.
Eyes of the World.
And I believe there was a "He's Gone" in the second set.
Yeah, and
Okay.
Samson, and Yeah, I'm not looking at a set list, but I'm kind of recalling everything
right.
here.
I think a Truckin' also, wasn't there?
Yeah, towards the end of the set, that was, and you may not have known this at the time, but it was incredibly exciting for people who followed the Dead for a long time. It was the first Truckin' in 3 years.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think of that as a rarity.
Yeah, it wasn't. You know, that was the first one they didn't play it in at all in 76. When they came back to touring, that was the first time they played it after the hiatus. And then it became a common song.
Yeah, and back then, remember, unlike now, it wasn't as easy to be up on set lists, right? You had to have like that Diamond Dupree's blue newspaper or something, or
yeah.
I mean, how did you even find out what set lists were?
Yeah, just when the 80s, a little easier, not because we had the information, just we knew more people were touring, and we would just go around and find someone who was at the shows before, you know, hey, were you at the shows? And,
that's kind of
how we did it in the 80s. But same thing, you have no computers, no way of finding, you don't even know, sometimes you didn't even know where they were playing next, let alone.
Yeah, so there's no way, like, this is the first time I've ever heard that the Truckin' was, like, somewhat of a bust out.
Yeah, and Eyes of the World was something which really hit me first time I hit the tape. How was that for you at the show? That must have been a...
The Eyes of the World, you know, in retrospect, like, listening to it afterwards, I appreciate it more now. At the time, I don't remember that being one of the songs that I thought was necessarily a highlight. Like looking back and listening to it now, yeah, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was I don't remember it in the same way I remember like the Bertha and the Half Step, you know, and et cetera. Like I remember hearing it and appreciating it, but not like worshiping it like I did some of the other songs.
Yeah, and the Not Fade Away was really long and huge,
well,
like the Truckin'.
The Not Fade Away, I think that was the second set closer, right?
Yeah, it was either
right.
Not Fade Away or Truckin'. In preparation for this, I haven't listened to it in a couple of years. I had to get the exact list down. I forget which way it went.
Pretty certain Not Fade Away was the second set closer. The other musical moment that I remember, again, vividly, is the encore was Terrapin. And I believe, I don't know how often Terrapin had been played prior to that, but I think it was kind of at the beginning. Terrapin was a relatively new song. You'd know better than me. You're on top
Yeah.
of that type of thing. But am I correct in assuming Terrapin was a relatively new song at that point?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was the new album had just come out. I think before before they played Terrapin, Phil said, hey, here's a new ditty from our new album. Which is available at record stores now. So that had just come out.
Was it the first Terrapin?
No, they did 77. During the year 77, they played a bunch of Terrapins. It was unusual that it was in the encore slot.
Right, right. And I don't know that I ever heard it in the encore slot again.
Yeah, no, that's very rare. It might be the only one. I'll have to double check that. If they did it in the encore slot, it was probably in the 77 era around then.
So here's a memory, and again, a very special one that I'll always remember. So once we knew it was an encore, we knew enough about the Dead, my friends and I, that they were, you know, it wasn't like Springsteen, his encore is practically a whole nother set. Like we knew for the Dead, the encore was one song. So as Terrapin started, we're like, why don't we, you know, start to make our way towards the exit, because we knew it was going to take us a long time to find our car, you know.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely be concerned with finding the car in that scene.
Yeah, and it was probably getting dark at that point. So we left as Terrapin was playing. But that being said, the sound was so good that as we were leaving, I didn't miss Terrapin. Like, we heard it the whole way. Even when we were outside the venue, trudging down the avenues, the back roads of Englishtown, you could still hear Terrapin. I mean, like, I felt like it was like our marching orders, like like I heard that over and over, and we were kind of like marching to it as we were going to our cars, and I did hear it when it finally ended. So I don't feel, even though we left and we were literally outside the venue, like I didn't not hear the Terrapin, if you know what I mean. Like,
oh, no, that sounds totally cool, man, because like to hear that Terrapin refrain as you're going to your car and it's nice and loud, That's a great way. That's a great last memory of Englishtown, then.
That perfect. That is my last memory of Englishtown was hearing that. And
compass always points to Terrapin. Doc Rich Weiss, you lucky son of a bitch. How cool is that? You're at a show leaving to the Terrapin refrain. Jim Daly, you're lucky, man. Just such a cool way to end it, man. That Terrapin refrain is such celebration and like kind of a sense of conquering for both the band and the fans out there. So just an incredible night and the perfect way it ended. A powerful, powerful Terrapin. Man, the Grateful Dead had balls back in 77, man. The stuff they played, the way they lined songs up and the way they played them, they were just full of such confidence. And so many reasons why this is perhaps the most important show the Grateful Dead ever played. But let's take a look at these songs, man. Just... All right, so it's so balanced, this show, between here's our new songs, here's our new direction, plus giving you the old songs. And there was no dirges, nothing slow. Not that there's anything wrong with that, we all love that. But Stella Blue, Wharf Rat, Ship of Fools, Black Peter, none of those kind of songs on this night. It was all a powerful presentation. They had 120,000 to 150,000 out there. Marshall Tucker crew in the house, a certain amount of fans there. So they wanted to impress. They kept it as lively. This is as lively as any show. There's like no boring part to it of any kind. Everything about this show is interesting. So from that aspect, it's just incredible what they did. Just a quick recap of the show. You got Promised Land, Love Each Other, Uncle, The Half Step, which we heard, A Great Looks Like Rain, fifth, Peggy O, sixth, one of the best Peggy O's you'll ever hear. It's a great two-guitar solo there, very hot, Minglewood. So once again, you're getting Minglewood, Friend of the Devil after that. Friend of the Devil is probably the slowest song on this night. So with Minglewood and Devil, you're getting songs, old-time Grateful Dead songs to mix with the new ones. And Music Never Stopped was one of the new ones, came out on Blues for Allah. This is it's a hot version of music. Because the year is 1977, there's no other way it could have turned out. But there's so many great musics in 77, this one doesn't stand up with them. But this show has so many great versions from it, it doesn't even matter. But this Music Never Stopped is such a positive. There wasn't a person there who wasn't completely enamored with it at the time. Second set. I think before the second set, Phil mentions about how exciting it is to be playing for such a great crowd. So, I mean, everybody felt it on that night. Yeah, just one of those once-in-a-lifetime night for even a band like the Grateful Dead. They come out ripping and rocking, Birth of Good Lovin'. I mean, after you've seen that like a whole bunch of times, you hear it a whole bunch on tapes, you forget how good it could be. This night, they were taking everything to the extra level. Excellent Birth of Good Lovin' opener. Awesome Loser in the third spot. And even when they would play a song like Loser, which may not be the most danceable, it's an incredible song. Might not be the most danceable, upbeat song. There was something about this English Town sound, man. It's just... everything they did is just, it was just perking with energy. One of the things which I really liked back in the early days, I'd be listening to this tape, the radio versions, like I liked the compressed radio sound, and English Town had that. So after Loser, you got the incredible Estimated Profit, Eyes of the World. Estimated Profit definitely hit the spot with the crowd, even though it's a new song. Eyes of the World speaks for itself. And then it's followed by Samson, another just ripping song. So there's like no let up, man. They got a enormous crowd out there and they just keep it rocking like crazy. So then after Samson, He's Gone. And once again, when I listen to this He's Gone, I don't even think of it being a slower song because there's just like there's a pacing to the show that's just ripping. And the He's Gone is great. Nice outro right into Not Fade Away. And man, this is one of the all-time great Not Fadeaways. They break it down, they build it up, and you gotta listen to it, man. It's up there with one of the best ever, kind of on the level of Cornell. Comparing this show to Cornell, I'd say Cornell still has his beat by the second set just a little bit. First set of English Town beats the Cornell set, so they're pretty damn close. But as far as legacy, I mean, Cornell is the most talked about show ever, but this show actually gave birth to so many more Deadheads. I mean, only 6,000 people are leaving Cornell, and the whole myth of that show didn't evolve until as years went by. The immediate impact of English Town, the Grateful Dead sold 100,000 people on the band that night, man, and everybody had to be a repeat guest after you went to that, man. So, just an incredible night, Not Fade Away. And the last song of the set, once again, just keeping it ripping and roaring, but probably the biggest surprise of the night, Truckin'. And they had not played Truckin' since 1974. So this was the first time Truckin' was put on the shelf for a little bit. So people at this point, I mean, when I was seeing the band in the 80s, we were not jonesing for Truckin'. We caught our fair share of Truckin's. Nothing wrong with it, but we caught Truckin' like every three nights or so. But this was like a three-year hiatus for Truckin'. So when they broke into Truckin', the place went nuts. On one hand, you got the new fans who are, this is like the song they hear on FM radio. And then the people who really know, who've seen the Grateful Dead before, who know the band, are like, holy shit, they haven't played Truckin' in 3 years. And they're all pumped up. So it was the perfect song to end the set on. And boy, do they rip the ending jam here. Just a fierce, unique sounding, unlike any other truck, and just an incredible way to end it. Then, of course, you go to the Terrapin Station Encore. You know, my God, just an incredible array of songs there. Once again, English Town, a one-of-a-kind love affair between the Grateful Dead and their devotees. I want to thank Doc Rich Weiss for joining me on the podcast, as well as Jim Daly. His books, once again, are Deadheads Remember English Town and Grateful Memories. Next week, Doug Schmell will be back. And we're going to look at, it's going to be the 50th anniversary of Alexandria Palace. We both agree our favorite of that three-night run is the September 9th, 1974 show. It has the most insane morning dew, so that by itself will make it an all-time favorite for me. And we'll be discussing that one next week. Look forward to speaking to Doug. He's digging into the show, prowling his neighborhood right now, listening to Alexandria Palace, getting ready for the podcast. And that's it for the English Town extravaganza. And once again, I'm your host, Howard Weiner. My book on Grateful Dead 77 is called Grateful Dead 77, The Rise of Terrapin Nation, available on Amazon with my other books, website tangledupintunes.com. And we're not going to do the typical outro tonight. We're going to play that trucking jam from English Town. It's so incredible, so unique. So everybody enjoy. Peace out.